lovely Marla English, Paramount picture actress, has been elected Miss Scorpion of 1954 by the men of the United States Air Force's 74th Flying Tiger Fighter Interceptor Squadron, who fly the Northrop Scorpion F-89 interceptors from Presque Isle in Maine. Marla demonstrates how she happened to win the coveted title Miss Scorpion of 1954. Here she models her idea of Flying Tiger summer flight gear. She also demonstrates there's lots of elbow room in the big two-man cockpit of the F-89. In addition to being a five-time beauty contest winner, Marla, as you can plainly see here, is the athletic type. Marla is a nickname. Her real name is Marlene Gale English, and she lives with her father and mother in West Los Angeles. Well, included in the 1954 class of June Bride,
Craft had an announcement today. It released the breathless news that petite Marla English, seen here, has been named Miss Scorpion of 1954 by men of the U.S. Air Force 74th Flying Tiger Fighter Interceptor Squadron, which is based in Maine. Marla, a Paramount starlet, soon to be seen in the Martin and Lewis picture, Living It Up, demonstrates what she thinks should be summer flight gear. And by the way, Marla has won no less than five beauty contests. No wonder the boys in Maine think she's the perfect flying partner to carry the proud title Miss Scorpion of 1954. Now some names in tonight's news.
Chris gets a new title from the men of the Air Force's 74th Flying Tiger Squad. Marla English, who's been Miss just about everything else, is now dubbed Miss Scorpion of 1954. And by Scorpion, the men mean this sleek Northrop jet interceptor. And now Marla demonstrates how she won the title. This is her idea, you see, of summer flight gear. The cockpits are roomy, even for Air Force pilots, bundled up in bulky flight clothes. And for Marla, it's even more so, and she makes herself quite at home. A pair of trim silhouettes is shown off here. Marla's the pride of Paramount Studios, and the Scorpions are the pride of the Northrop Aircraft Company and the men who guard our nation's coastlines.
Prairie Avenue. So we'll see you Saturday at the Youth Benefit Parade beginning at 11:45 a.m. In Los Angeles, airplanes like this Scorpion F-89 operate at altitudes where human blood would boil at normal temperature without cockpit pressurization equipment. To learn what may be expected at high altitudes, Northrop aircraft engineers place a toy balloon inside a new altitude chamber built to test equipment in the coming planes and missiles. The 8-foot airtight door is sealed in place. The balloon begins expanding. This chamber and pump transport the balloon to 130,000 feet above sea level, in effect. Instruments provide accurate readings on the altitude chamber. Absolute control can be maintained to check valuable parts at predetermined test altitudes. It's under the strain experienced at 70,000 feet. Engineers look forward to flights which will extend 20 miles or more above the Earth. Miles finds out what it's like to fly 10 miles above the Earth up there in the stratosphere. The preparation is the hardest part. First of all, you have to pass an Air Force physical, including an electrocardiogram. Then you take a simulated flight in the altitude chamber, which takes up to 40,000 feet without leaving the ground. Inside the decompression chamber, you learn about the dangers of stratospheric flight. After the oxygen plug is pulled, you feel the effects of hypoxia. Oxygen starvation. You'd black out in less than 2 minutes. With the oxygen back on, revival is quick. All this to demonstrate the great dangers in flying at high altitude where the air temperature outside is 67 below zero. Only a plastic can poise between you and sudden death. Then there's another trick to be mastered, the high explosive ejection seat that shoots you out into the wild blue yonder if anything goes wrong. It's a long way to terra firma from the stratosphere, and anything can happen. After last minute instruction from test pilot Bob Love, Korean War ace, Times aviation editor Marvin Miles is ready for his journey into space. He's said to be the first newspaperman ever to fly at the dizzy altitude of 53,000 feet. Think of it. That's about 4.5 miles higher than Mount Everest, in a silent, freezing space world more than 2 miles into the stratosphere. We certainly salute you, Mr. Miles.
Something we like very much to spin for you, rather a special occasion, you might say. It's called Lend Your Leisure to Your NRC. It's a novelty song written by, for, and about the people of Northrop Aircraft Incorporated, with words and music by Hal Chancellor of Northrop's Personnel Activities Department, Land Your Leisure to Your NRC is a rollicking tune just created, well, as a salute to the Northrop Recreation Club, which has long been known to all Northrop personnel and their families as the NRC. The Pied Pipers, as I say, are on the record. They do the vocalizing, and they're accompanied by another Northrop employee, Hal Thomas, and his Californians. And as I mentioned, the Lend Your Leisure to Your NRC is a salute to Hal Chancellor, Hal Thomas, and the other 24,000 Northrop personnel who are working, building the United States Air Force Scorpion F-89 all-weather interceptor. It's a clear morning, but I can't seem to get by my eye teeth at all. Also, these Northrop people, as some of you may know, are building the Snark XB-62. It's a pilotless bomber. And they're also working on many other vital assignments for the American arsenal of defense, as we all very well know. So as a salute to all of you, here is Hal Thomas and the Californians with Hal Chancellor's tune, Lend Your Leisure to Your NRC, is sung by the Pied Pipers.
Lend your leisure hours to your NRC. Get the recreation habit. No tension you can mention will cause you apprehension if you find your favorite fun and grab it. When the whistle blows, you're on your own. Join the happy crowd, don't sit there sighing. Everybody knows it's not smart to be alone, but there's a way to cure the blues without half trying. So lend your leisure hours to your NRC. Live it up and laugh today, right now. Live it up and learn to play. Maybe you'd like to bowl or swim or make your figure slim or trim or play a little golf with folks you know. There's everything that you could wish, from chess and bridge to tropical fish, a camera club and shortwave radio.
There are no dues, the whole darn thing is free.
The Northrop Recreation Club, for you and me. Lend your leisure hours to your NRC. Take advantage of your chances. You'll find a new sensation in full participation in the sport and your department dances. When your day is done, you'll find delight in the things we plan for your enjoyment. Try them one by one, every day and every night. They're a very pleasant part of your employment. So lend your leisure hours to your NRC. Live it up and learn to play today. Live it up.
Lend Your Leisure to Your NRC, written by Hal Chancellor of the Northrop's Personnel Activities Department. Must be nice to get paid for writing music or something. Maybe he didn't get paid, I don't know. It's a real cute novelty tune, and I'll let you in on a little hint right now. Somebody put a wee bit of a crack across the record. Not much, just a wee bit of a crack. I don't think you could hear it at all. Sort of hoping it would hold out, and it did. I guess it'll play for quite some time to come. Been a pleasure playing it for you. Right now, though, here's the latest beach weather report from General Motors Acceptance.
Ray flies and tests the Air Force most heavily armed fighter interceptor, the Scorpion F-89. He was the first man to test fire rockets from the Scorpion in flight. In a moment, we're going to show you motion pictures of Ray doing that very thing. Then we'll show you the first motion pictures ever released of the Scorpion's rockets being fired from the pilot's point of view. But right now, I'd like you to meet Ray Tenhoff. Ray, you're the man flying the Scorpion and firing the rockets in the film that we're about to see, are you not?
Well, Mr. Goodwin, all Scorpions look pretty much alike. The pilot could have been Lou Nelson, our chief. Could have been Bill Cooter, myself.
I see. Well, suppose we run the film, and while it's on the screen, you can tell us firsthand something about how it feels like to fly a Scorpion. For example, I've often heard that when you're flying in the plane, you don't hear the noise that we hear on the ground. Is that true, Ray?
Well, yes, the pilot isn't aware of the high engine noise level. The major portion of the noise is behind the airplane.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at that film right now, okay?
Now, I understand also those are rocket pods out on the tips of the wings. Is that correct?
That's right. Wingtip placement of the rocket pods produces a number of combat advantages. Not only can large numbers of rockets be carried in the wingtip pods, but firing of rockets does not interfere with vision of the crew at the critical moment of interception.
Now, another advantage you're going to tell us about here.
Well, the engine intakes are far enough from the pods to be free of flying debris that the rockets sometimes produce.
Ray, how many rockets do you have?
Well, the F-89D is armed with 104. These are 2.75 air-to-air folding fin rockets. There's 55 in each pod. Each one is capable of downing the largest bomber with a single hit. Kill probabilities are high in combat since the target area blanketed when all rockets are fired is about the size of a football field. Wingtip pods provide improved dispersal of rockets since two sources of firepower are used instead of a single concentrated source.
I see. Do you fire all 104 at one time?
They can be fired that way, in a single giant volley, or they can be fired in groups. This enables a Scorpion to make as many as three passes at a single target or to move in for the kill on three separate enemy aircraft.
Are there two men in that plane, Ray?
Yes, the pilot and the radar observer. They're seated tandem in a pressurized cockpit.
Mm-hmm. Is there a kick like a shotgun when you fire air-to-air rockets?
There isn't as high an impact as you might expect. The slow-motion pictures of the rockets coming out of the pods kind of give you an idea how smooth they are.
Uh-huh. Well, now, these pictures certainly give us a good impression of how things look to you when you're up there. By the way, how high do you fly that plane?
Well, Mr. Goodman, we're allowed to admit about 8 miles. However, I read in the paper the other day where Marvin Miles, a newspaper reporter, had been up to 53,000 feet in a Scorpion.
Oh, I get it. All righty. Well, thanks a lot, Ray, for giving us an idea of how it feels as well as how it looks up wherever you are when you're firing those rockets. There they went from close up. On our screen there, and boy, they really come flying out of there, don't they, Ray? There they go again. This is the first time that this has been shown on television and released, and we certainly hope that you folks out there who are interested in the welfare of our country and what we're doing can appreciate this and understand exactly what test pilots like Ray here is doing and others just like him throughout the nation. Now, this is taken from the where the pilot sits. Isn't that right, Ray?
That's affirmative.
Uh-huh. How many rockets were let go that time?
104.
Well, Ray, I want to thank you very, very much for being with us tonight, and certainly always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much. Well, even though we hope it will always be only test rockets, it's reassuring to know that we have planes like the Northrop Scorpion, and fellas like Ray are up there testing them. Today, F-89s are operational with Air Defense Command Fighter Interceptor Squadrons spanning the continent, from Alaska to Greenland, to protect major industrial centers in the United States.
Tactically, they're all-weather interceptors, and actually, they're the heaviest-armed fighter planes in the world. This one carries 104 air-to-air rockets. These remarkable films show for the first time the tremendous concentration of firepower packed inside the nose and wing pods of this Northrop-built Scorpion. A pilot's view and that single salvo of rockets rakes and churns an area the size of a football field. A hit by just one will knock any known enemy plane from the sky. And now just watch this. Slow motion, the rocket.
This interview is being conducted at the Palmdale Airport, Northrop Facilities, in the heart of the fast-growing Antelope Valley. And we have with us Mr. Lovelady, the 1,000th employee to go into the Northrop facility in Palmdale at the airport. Mr. Lovelady, I understand that you're a native of the community here, is that right?
Yes, sir. I was born and raised in Little Rock.
I see. And how old are you?
I'm just 20 years old.
That's interesting, and you've just recently gotten out of the Navy. Tell us about that.
Well, I joined in May 1951 through boot camp in San Diego. From there, I went to electronics school, Treasure Island, San Francisco, and then aboard the USS Jason, where I served most of the time in Japan and San Diego.
And you were born and raised right here in Little Rock, in the Valley.
That's right.
I see. And let's see, and this is your first day at Northrop?
Yes, it is.
Good. And what was your training in the Navy? Did it help you at all in with your job here?
I believe it has so far from the work that I've been doing.
I see. They hired you in as an electronics man, is that right?
Well, it's assembly, electronics, and radio, yes, sir, it is.
And that's what you like to do?
Of course.
Well, it's a good opportunity to have things like this turn up around your home locale so you can take part in it. Are you intend to stay here in the valley for a while?
Right at the present, yes, sir, I do very much.
I see. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Lovelady. And as the 1,000th employee at the Northrop Palmdale facilities, we wish you the very best of luck.
Weatherman predicts cloudy tonight. Most voices will be heard at that time. This hearing the first since the Army-McCarthy controversy. There's a big battle raging in Indochina tonight. The biggest French offensive in weeks. Heavy losses on both sides reported. 10,000 mobile French infantry units backed by tanks, by artillery and warplanes smashed the rebel positions near Hanoi. Chased the Reds from scores of strong points there. It's the first French victory on the Indochina battlefront in months. And as that battle rages, the war of words drags on at Geneva. Once again, history repeating itself, with Mr. Vyacheslav Molotov following the example, the pattern of Adolf Hitler. He now refuses to accept French proposals for partition of Indochina at the 18th parallel. Molotov is holding out for partition further south, all the way down to the 14th parallel. And this would virtually push the French out of Vietnam. Molotov's stubborn stand virtually evaporates French and British optimism tonight. With the peace talks deadlocked, time is running out for France's tough new premier, Pierre Mendès-France. He has just 4 days to fulfill his pledge of peace by July the 20th or resign. In Los Angeles, Mrs. Trinidad Vera is found sane by the same jury that convicted her of mistreating her daughter. The 28-year-old mother faces a possible 64 years in prison, having been found guilty of assault and mayhem in the 2-year torture of her 9-year-old daughter. Visibly shaken by the jury's verdict, Mrs. Vera collapses, has to be carried to her cell in county jail. The complete collapse comes after she tells her attorney, "I'm very sick." Judge Mildred Lilly believes she may require treatment as a sex psychopath in a state hospital. Tonight, these names make news. Irving Berlin, the songwriter, receives a gold medal for the writing of such tunes as "God Bless America." Berlin and his wife attend a White House ceremony today. Asked what the president had to say, Berlin replies, "I was so emotionally filled up, I don't remember." Mr. Norman Chandler, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times, has entered Good Samaritan Hospital for a routine checkup. He suffered a virus infection while vacationing in Hawaii. Senator William Langer, the North Dakota Republican, calls the foreign aid program a gigantic swindle. Over his objections, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee sends a $3 billion foreign aid bill to the Senate floor. Carol Chessman, the convict author still trying to escape that date with death, July the 30th, he asked the state Supreme Court for help in his 6-year fight to avoid the San Quentin prison gas chamber. Genevieve Amont, the beautiful French-born actress, sues her husband Harry Reginald for divorce. Accompanied to court by her attorney, Bentley Harris, Genevieve testifies that she pleaded with her husband for a home of their own, but in the 5.5 years of married life, she and her husband lived with Reginald's family. "We had no privacy," she says. "I begged him to get a place so that we could be alone, but he didn't get it." Genevieve wins a default divorce. John A. Carpenter, the veteran Los Angeles police officer, pleads guilty to a dope charge, says he took the stuff to get experience so that he could be assigned to the narcotics detail. His pretty girlfriend, Bella Jacques, also involved in the dope charges, but the case against her is dismissed for lack of evidence. Carpenter, a veteran of 7 years, is a motorcycle officer on the Los Angeles Police Department force. Today, Grantland Rice was laid to rest in Woodlawn Cemetery in New York. So many fine tributes have been written about that great gentleman of sports. One friend calls Granny the kindest, finest man this side of heaven, and now, as he puts it, he's crossed over. The young man from Denver, Gene Fowler, says Granny Rice lived the Sermon on the Mount. Henry McNamara writes, "Grantland Rice believes there's something nice and genuine in everyone. He believes that the wrong people do is against their natures, and if given a chance to be stand-up folk, they'd be just that. Says Henry McLemore, Granny Rice walks, plumes never touching the ground, as gently in Hollywood as in Washington. He is the one newspaperman who was never told this is off the record. He knew what should be on the record and what should be kept off. Yes, ask Douglas MacArthur about Granny Rice. Ask Crosby, ask Pope, ask Fowler, ask John Lardner, ask Red Smith, and all the rest. McLemore wants only one epitaph put on his headstone. He wants them to write, he was a friend of Granton Rice. This, says McLemore, will prove to the world that I wasn't really too bad. Granny Rice had a premonition of death many years ago. He dedicated this poem to his dear friend, Gene Hollywood. It's titled, At Sports Wayside Inn, or An Old Timer Has a Dream. I'd like to read it for you tonight. The lights at the Wayside Inn were dim, and yet they carried a friendly glow. As one by one, the old guard came from years I knew in the long ago. There was Bolger and Mercer and Urban Cobb, McPhat, Condon, Harry Cross, Runyon, Igo, and old Sam Crane, pals from a past that had known its loss. Lardner, McGeehan, and Haywood Bruin, no wonder the candles leaped with light. Sharon had brought them back again in his mystic bark for another night. And the Wayside Inn held a radiance that shattered the darkness overhead, and the inn was cluttered with golden words, though never a spoken word was said. We sat together without a sound, where each one knew what the others meant. What use were words in a group like this, troopers back in a vanished tent? Here's one for the road, I called at last. Lights out for the years that come and pass. And each picked up his traveler's cloak to leave me there with an empty glass. And now Granny's gone to join the rest, his team. And again in his own words, when the great umpire marks the score beside your name, he will not ask who won or lost, but how you played the game. All the living champions of whom he wrote were there today to pay their respects to Granny Rice, who played the game so very well. A violent explosion in a fireworks factory rocks the town of Chestertown, Maryland today. 10 dead, more than 50 injured. It's amazing there weren't more. A series of explosions lasting for 90 minutes flatten the buildings as if hit by a blockbuster bomb. Authorities are moving everyone out of that town because of the danger that one more magazine full of high explosives may let go. Another fireworks factory blast kills three men in a suburb of Chicago this afternoon. It may have been the heat in both instances.